Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Thursday, December 28th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you with us today. This week, we're looking back on some of the defining issues of 2017. On Wednesday, we talked about the year in protest in sports with Jelani Cobb of The New Yorker. And today, we're going to turn the lens on ourselves, the news media. There have been some true journalistic triumphs this year. David Begno of CBS News and a lot of others refused to let America turn away as Puerto Rico foundered after Hurricane Maria. Nima El-Baghir went undercover for CNN and exposed hard evidence of human slave auctions in Libya. The Miami Herald detailed death and the systematic abuse of children in Florida's Department of Juvenile Justice. And Jody Cantor and Megan Towey of The New York Times and Ronan Farrow of The New Yorker exposed to the public what was known in the entertainment industry for years, the abuses and sexual harassment of Harvey Weinstein, and they helped launch the Me Too movement in the process. If the exposure of widespread sexual harassment was a triumph for the news media, it was also a failure. That abuse is rife in our own ranks. Charlie Rose, Mark Halperin, the former host of this show, John Hockenberry. And all the while, the press is under constant attack from its own government.
That was just fake news by NBC, which gives a lot of fake news.
I called the fake news the enemy of the people, and they are.
I think you've set a new bar today for being contentious with the press corps, kind of calling us losers to our faces and all that.
No, not all of you, just many of you.
All right, fine. Can you give us a question?
Don't be rude. No, I'm not going to give you a question. I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
Is 2017 a defining year for the news media? Are we at a crossroads? Joining me now, Bill Adair, Knight Professor of Journalism and Public Policy at Duke, and the founder of PolitiFact, the fact-checking website. Also, Joanne Littman, Editor-in-Chief of USA Today and the USA Today Network, also author of the new book, That's What She Said, What Men Need to Know and Women Need to Tell Them About Working Together. Joanne, Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks
good to
for
be
having
here.
Me.
Great to have you both. Joanne, I want to start with you, and I want to start with a failure that actually predated 2017, and it was the news media's handling of the presidential campaign. It's a good way to sort of frame, I think, the discussion of this year, not because Donald Trump won the election, but some clear failures in proportionality and focus. We as an industry seemed largely unprepared for the Trump phenomenon, the gleeful disregard of facts, the undermining of the basic agreement that good faith arguments should win the day in politics and in journalism. How has the self-assessment gone, and how's the news media doing now, 1 year in?
Sure. So first of all, if you're looking at 2016, I think one of the major issues that we saw is that the major, particularly national media, is really based on the coast and has retreated to the coasts. There was a survey done that found that one out of every five journalists is based in either New York, Washington, D.C., or Los Angeles. So what we saw in 2016 was this sort of conventional wisdom in these big coastal cities where people really, the journalists, were not really in the heartland, were not in the rest of the country, understanding where the electorate was going and understanding, you know, people relied on polls, which said that Donald Trump would not win, and relied on sort of the media bubble circles talking to one another. And I've got to say that that is one thing why we created the USA Today Network, which not everybody understands what that is. Gannett is the parent company, owns USA Today, which everyone knows is the national newspaper. We also own 109 local papers, 109, the Detroit Free Press, the Des Moines Register, the Arizona Republic. And what we've done with the USA Today Network is actually created with USA Today as the flagship this nationwide network. And so we have very, very consciously gone out to make sure that you hear those voices in our audience. And we were particularly focused on that in this year, 2017, because our audience is half red, red and half blue. We are very deeply in Tennessee, in red areas of Florida, in Phoenix, in Arizona. And so we are able to kind of give a platform to voices of people who felt previously that they were not being heard. And I think that that has been a real lesson from 2016 and something that we have doubled down on to great effect this year.
Bill, Joanne's company is not only running the big paper, USA Today, but also these 109 local papers. Look, you're in the business of fact-checking there at PolitiFact. We're in an environment now where to report the facts about the Trump administration is to be called a liar and a subversive by the president of the United States. How's the news media responded and borne up under this new paradigm?
Yeah, I think that's been really troubling. And if you had to pick the low light of the year, I think it would be the way the press has been portrayed by people in power in Washington. I think the best response, and I think the media has responded generally pretty well, is just to do great work and to avoid the name calling, to respond when something substantive is raised. But not to get too caught up in, hey, he called us the enemy of the American people. That's awful. You know, let's just go do great work. Let's hold power accountable. And I really think that's what's happened.
Do you think that the judgment is back yet about whether that's enough? We all tell ourselves that reporting the facts, doing good work is its own reward in a democracy and will be enough eventually. Do we know that yet?
Well, I do think more needs to be done. One thing that I think news organizations need to do better is to be more transparent about their work, to show their work when they're doing investigative reporting. You know, this is something we've seen much more in the last couple of years. The best one that comes to mind is David Farenthold's work for the Washington Post, where he did it very openly on Twitter. Hey, here's my legal pad. These are the charities that I've looked at so far. And I think we need to do that more. I also think getting away from the name calling, but getting to more specifics, that media executives need to speak up more. And I think they became complacent in the 90s and the last 15 years, and they haven't responded well when they have been under attack with accusations of bias. And I think that's a place where it's not about name calling, it's about responding, hey, this is objective journalism. I also think news organizations need to do a better job educating people, working with the schools to teach young people how to consume media in this new world.
Well, Joanne, let's talk about executives and some of the new paradigm. The Me Too movement has revealed several things: the depressing frequency of sexual harassment by men in our industry, and also that very few major newsrooms are led by women. Now, Joanne, you're a relatively rare case in journalism, a woman who leads a major news organization. There's a lot of gender equality in the early years of the profession, a lot of women, a lot of men among the ranks of reporters, you know, in their 20s and 30s. But as Farai Chidea pointed out on this show, as people advance further in seniority, you find fewer and fewer women in leadership roles. How's the industry doing from your point of view?
Yeah, I think the media industry is not unlike a lot of other industries. This is one of the reasons I wrote the book, That's What She Said, which will be out January 30th. The issue we have is that every level that you go up, every promotional level, women are 15% less likely to be promoted. And this is in general. This is not just in the media industry. So you've got a lot of industries, including our own, where you probably start out with a pretty close to 50-50 entry-level group. But at every level, women are less likely to be promoted. And so by the time you get to the top, you're overwhelmingly male. And, you know, that impacts us in so many ways. I mean, in the media industry, I think that it's, you know, part of the progress, actually, that we've seen is the fact that we can talk about things like sexual harassment and it will be taken seriously. I mean, if you think about the difference between what's happening right now and the outcry over sexual harassment and the issues, not just in the media industry, but across the board in multiple industries, you think about that versus Even a year ago, with Bill Cosby, and in previous cases, with other very highly publicized cases of sexual harassment at work, it hasn't had the same impact. And I think that that actually is a sign of progress in our industry. But if you want to know, like, how do we eliminate this, right? You know, first of all, one of the major issues is we need more women in leadership, period. Like, that alone would make a difference. Because there you have women who are in our own industry, in the media industry, first of all, taking these issues seriously. And secondly, you have, you know, less, it becomes less acceptable within the culture to have these issues. The one other thing I would point out, though, is the focus has been on the most extreme cases, sexual assault in the workplace, cases like Harvey Weinstein, people who are sexual predators. The reason I believe that there's been such an outcry among women and in the general population is that women, not every woman has been sexually assaulted at work, but every woman everywhere in any job, in any industry, knows what it feels like to be marginalized, overlooked, underestimated, interrupted. And as a result, I think there's just been this pent-up frustration that has just really exploded because of this.
And I think that one of the additional things that this phenomenon has uncovered, the importance of it, Joanne, not only having women in leadership roles in media organizations, the rampant abuse itself, which is the basis of the story, but also who gets to tell the story. And I think that media is learning a very hard and very important lesson about who frames the response and who frames the reporting, the journalism, and the storytelling around treatment of women and sexual harassment. And that's something I think we're going to continue to reckon with in 2018.
It's incredibly important. Actually, I do think that the issue of the story, taking the story seriously, you know, if you think about it, the stories about Bill Cosby were largely sort of on the entertainment pages, right? It wasn't really real news, whereas it now, sexual harassment has really become something that everyone, you know, and particularly the men who are running a lot of the media organizations are taking very seriously.
Bill Adair, about a minute before we have to let you go, but let's look forward to 2018. It's going to be upon us. Look, the Russia investigation's probably going to come to a head in the next several months. There's going to be a lot of high-profile challenges for the news media. What do you think is the biggest test coming at us?
Well, I think the big one is to regain our credibility with a big portion of the American population that has been told that the news media is fake news, that it's biased. And I think media companies and academics and rank-and-file journalists need to speak up and let people know about objective journalism, how it's important in our media world, and try to restore the credibility of the news organizations. Because the journalists are doing great work. I think 2017 was an exceptional year for great journalism, but we have to tell our own story better.
And let some of the great reporting and some of the great facts being reported, not only about the administration, but in local communities around the country, do a lot of the speaking for us. Bill Adair, Knight Professor of Journalism of Public Policy at Duke and founder of PolitiFact. Thanks so much, Bill.
Thanks for having me.
And also Joanne Littman, Editor-in-Chief of USA Today. Thanks so much, Joanne.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we want to know what you think. How did the news media perform in 2017?
This is Rob from Tarpon Springs, Florida. Journalism has failed politically in propping up Hillary Clinton and marginalizing Bernie Sanders, and now we have the disaster of the Trump presidency. The news media also failed to adequately cover the magnitude of police brutality in our nation, our role and responsibility for the horrific state of affairs in the Middle East, the rise of ISIS, and so on, and the magnitude of environmental disaster that's coming our way.
Monica, and I'm calling from Denver. The media did exactly what it was supposed to do. However, the problem is journalists didn't hold journalists responsible to maintain and sustain journalistic integrity. If this work would have been done in the election, we wouldn't be in the political climate we are in right now.
My name is Michael. I'm calling from Eastern Pennsylvania. The media have almost completely failed to inform the public of the tremendous environmental damage being done and that will be done, both short and long term, as a result of Trump's emasculation of the EPA. The Environmental Protection Agency was established for a reason. We are abdicating our responsibility to our children's future This is unacceptable.
Your thoughts on your news media in 2017. Tell us what you think. 8778-MY-TAKE. We go to Myanmar now in our ongoing coverage of the persecution of the Rohingya people there. Earlier this month, two journalists for Reuters who were reporting on the ongoing Rohingya refugee crisis were detained by Burmese police.
The two journalists, Wa Long and Cho Seo-yo, were part of our bureau.
That's Reg Chua, chief operating officer for Reuters News.
They were invited to dinner with two policemen. They accepted, as you would, obviously, in figuring out, you know, what these policemen might be telling them. They got there, the driver dropped them off, and then essentially they never came out. So we came back, we spent a whole night looking for them, we got no answers, and then the next day we found out they'd been arrested and that they were looking at charging them under the Official Secrets Act, which is a very broad and pretty draconian law that potentially imprisons people for up to 14 years.
Well, how exactly that law is being applied here is unclear. 2 days ago, a judge in Myanmar extended the two journalists' detention by another 14 days. Now, while their fate remains in question, mounting international condemnation is putting the spotlight on what many see as an attack on press freedom. Phil Robertson is deputy director of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. He says that these types of media crackdowns have become increasingly common over the last year as the Burmese government continues its atrocities against the Rohingya people.
Wa Long and Cho Seo-yo are two very experienced Burmese journalists. Certainly Wa Long was one of the best journalists at the Myanmar Times, a national newspaper before joining Reuters. And they've been looking at the situation that the world has been focused on, which is the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya in northern Rakhine State. And this is precisely what they were looking at when they were detained. This is a story that they have been following really since August, when the whole situation went so badly in northern Rakhine State. And now we have, I think, about 800,000 Rohingya have been driven out of the country into Bangladesh.
Well, Wa Long and Cho Seo-yo met with police and were charged with illegally collecting information with the intent to distribute it to foreign news media. Was this what we would think of in America as entrapment or some kind of sting by the government?
It's unclear how the government actually knew that they were meeting with the two policemen who passed them the documents. And they've been hit with a law that is so broad, the Official Secrets Act, that almost any sort of situation can be applied to it. It basically allows the authorities to define anything that they consider to be a secret or something as a threat to national security and make the passing of that or receiving that an illegal act. You know, like many of the badly drafted laws that military governments used in the past and that unfortunately this democratic government is using, they are allow sort of maximum discretion for the officials making the determination on how to charge to allow this to happen. And what we're seeing with this case here is that, you know, it's not even made clear what sort of document they received. It's not clear whether anything has happened to the two police who are alleged to have passed this document. But what also is clear is that they weren't allowed access to their lawyer until actually minutes before they were brought into their first court hearing. So there's been failures not only, infringing on freedom of the press, but there's also a problem with the judicial process in Burma as well.
And we should be clear, if it's not clear already, whether this might be a legitimate breach of Burmese law, as broad and as bad as that law may be, or whether it's simply an effort by the government to keep the truth of atrocities against the Rohingya in Rakhine State from getting out.
Well, we think it's probably a little bit of both. I think that the government has been really targeting the media over the past year and a half. We have seen efforts against the Myanmar Times, a journalist named Fiona McGregor, who was fired after complaints from the government. We have seen journalists who are reporting in northern Shan State detained. We have journalists who flew a drone in Naypyidaw who have been detained and now in prison. And now we have this case. It seems to me that there's a broad trend taking place here where this government of Aung San Suu Kyi is harking back to the practices of the previous military governments where laws were used to restrict reporting and to, when necessary, imprison the messenger.
And does Aung San Suu Kyi, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, have control ultimately over these arrests and these detentions? Could she put a stop to them?
She certainly could. You know, she has authority over the Ministry of Justice, and she has authority over the prosecutors. You know, this is a decision where we believe that she was probably aware of this before the arrest took place. You know, there's been broached possibilities that there might have been some sort of surveillance or wiretapping of these people. So we don't know really, to be honest, what has happened. But what is clear is these are the kind of extreme steps that the government has taken to try to prevent access to what is happening in Northern Rakhine State.
What's the immediate future of these two reporters? Do we know when they might stand trial or what's next for them?
Well, their next hearing in the court is scheduled for January 10th. They have now been moved to Insane Prison. So previously they were being held at an interrogation center where they were being interrogated by the police without access to lawyers and without access to immediate family members. So we expect that they're going to go to trial. I think now what's going to have to happen is there has to be a significant larger outcry by the international community to escalate this further and raise the concerns about whether media freedom is something that is valued by the Burmese government, and to raise concerns that without access to information, you know, all sorts of abuses are going to continue and worsen.
And Phil, while these two journalists, Wallone and Kalsou, are being detained, let's not let the story go silent. Remind us of what's going on in Rakhine State. Remind us of what's going on with the persecution of the Rohingya.
Well, we have now well over 350 villages that were destroyed. We have, in this latest iteration, 650,000 people that were pushed out of Burma since August 25th, joining another 300,000 or so that were already in Bangladesh. We have a complete and total denial of human rights abuses in any way, shape, or form by the Burmese military. Aung San Suu Kyi is complicit in this, and you know, the international community is going to have to pressure for a full fact-finding by an independent international group. It could be the UN. We already have a fact-finding mission that they're now looking to these things, but they're being denied access to the country. So it's going to be a long slog now, but we're calling for the people responsible to be brought before the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and we're calling for sanctions against specific individuals who are identified as culpable, and that includes people in the military, but also maybe border police, and also maybe the civilian government.
Phil Robertson, Deputy Director of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
It was just over 2 weeks ago that Roy Moore became the first Republican to lose a U.S. Senate seat in Alabama in 25 years. Democrat Doug Jones won that seat that was, of course, vacated by Jeff Sessions when he became attorney general. Now Roy Moore is looking to block officials in Alabama from certifying that victory for Jones. Last night, Roy Moore filed a lawsuit for the delay, citing systematic voter fraud. So Pat Duggins is here, news director with Alabama Public Radio, to explain what's going on in Alabama. Pat, welcome.
Thank you, Todd.
Pat, Roy Moore says systematic voter fraud in his race. Is there any evidence of that?
Nope. And that's coming directly from the Secretary of State, John Merrill, who is basically in charge of votes in Alabama. He says if there are any indications of any kind of voter irregularities or fraud, he'll look at them. He says that up to this point, there is no indication other than Jones won.
So Roy Moore is a candidate and a figure in Alabama with a long career and a history of misdirection. What is he saying here that points to voter fraud, or at least in his view?
He hasn't presented any actual evidence of it. He simply says that there are indications, blah, blah, blah. Apparently, he had like one of his supporters who actually used mathematics to prove that there was some kind of a major conspiracy behind the JFK assassination. And he says, well, that's just enough for me to say that there's something wrong here in Alabama. Everybody's got their pet theory as to why this is happening. You want to hear mine?
Oh, Pat, I want to hear yours most of all.
Okay. Roy Moore wants to run for governor.
Oh, and this is how he stays in the public eye. This is how he stays in the papers.
Absolutely, because if you look at what's been going on right now, number one, it's the old Trump card, if you'll pardon the expression, where he says, oh, there's voter irregularity and all this sort of stuff, and that gets his voter base all fired up, and these are the very, you know, tend to be old, tend to be evangelical Christians who tend to believe that, you know, nasty carpetbaggers like you folks out of New York are going to come down here and, you know, and change Alabama and do all this sort of stuff. There was an admission from Highway 31 that was a major Democratic PAC. They spent millions of dollars supporting Doug Jones, and now all of a sudden that plays into that same kind of nasty old carpetbagger thing coming down to Alabama. So there are already political pundits out there that have been, you know, going on record saying what personally I've been thinking almost since the election, that if Roy Moore can't win the Senate race in Alabama, that he's going to go for the next best thing, and that's a shot for the governor.
Well, we'll see if this keeps Roy Moore in the news long enough to mount a successful campaign. But Pat, you talked about that Trump card. And I wonder about that. Look, President Trump himself, who won the election, still says that massive voter fraud cost him the popular vote, that millions of people voted illegally, and that's why he actually lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by 2.3 million votes. How are Alabamans likely to respond to this claim from Moore, whether it's about the governor's race or not, that rampant voter fraud was the reason he wasn't successful? He seems to be normalizing a claim here that Donald Trump has worked hard to normalize as well.
Well, Trump, I mean, people will probably take numbers and get in line to talk about how Donald Trump's ego may be playing into that. In other words, he has to have the biggest vote count, the biggest tax cut, the biggest collection of people for his inauguration, which everybody can sit and look at numbers and say, I'm sorry, that really didn't happen. With Roy Moore, I still think it gets back into that xenophobia that exists in Alabama. I mean, following the Civil War, you had the Union troops coming in basically telling Alabama what to do. Following the Civil Rights era of the 1960s, which Alabama brought on itself, you had the federal government coming in. All so there really is that distrust of outsiders and outside ideas. So anytime somebody like Roy Moore can say, hey, there's somebody out there coming into Alabama and doing this or that or this or that, that is going to fire up a certain political base in Alabama, mainly the evangelicals that supported Roy Moore, that will support him no matter what. And then on the other hand, you've got the Doug Jones types who are saying, look, we don't have to be on the wrong side of history. Why don't we kind of like get a little bit progressive? Maybe people won't think of us as a national punchline anymore, but you're still going to have those people out there who really think that the world is out to get them. And if Moore can keep them all fired up, if he goes for governor, and that's where it's going to get interesting, then he could definitely count on that base as he moves forward.
Well, Roy Moore says rampant voter fraud cost him that Senate seat. There's no evidence of it, but Pat Duggins, who knows a thing or two, says look toward the governor's race in 2018 in Alabama. You're likely to see Roy Moore pop up there as well. Pat Duggins, thanks so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, even if you're back at work, it's still Christmas vacation for all the school kids in America. It's about halfway through the school year now, and as kids come back, many seniors across the country are going to be waiting to find out if they've been accepted to the college of their choice. Well, we've been following how education and job training are changing across this country with our series, America's New Credentials. And we go to one high school in Manhattan now that's prioritizing work skills just as highly as four-year degrees. Rob Gunther has the story.
Here in New York City, just a few blocks from the 6th train in Harlem, is Cristo Rey, a Catholic high school that takes a unique approach to preparing its students for the future. The curriculum marries education and workforce training, creating a foundation for the type of upward social mobility that can lead to a middle-class lifestyle.
Hi, my name is Ryan Shibb. I am the History Department Chair, and I teach world history and American history.
Okay, number three, find two numbers whose sum is 160.
In many ways, Cristo Rey looks and sounds just like any other New York City high school. But it stands apart, both for their mission to serve often underrepresented communities and for their signature corporate work-study program.
Our students, you know, they come from underprivileged families who have not generally had access to the same education that their more privileged peers would have. And so, one, we certainly work to get them up to grade level by the time they're ready for college. But while we do that, they're also working one day a week in various law firms, banks, hospitals, businesses throughout the city to finance their education.
It's part of a national network of private schools. Cristo Rey New York relies on these corporate work-study jobs to finance the bulk of its students' education.
The official tuition cost is $2,000. It costs about $15,000 to educate a student in New York City. By the students working, they raise about half of that, and then the other half of that we fundraise for. So the $2,000 helps to offset that, but a significant number of our students don't actually pay $2,000. They pay less based on their financial need.
Now, plenty of high school kids around the country work part-time jobs, but the demands and expectations of a Cristo Rey education are high. Students are required to compress a rigorous 5-day school week into just 4 days.
Our students generally come in about two grade levels behind, and we only get 4 days a week to teach them because of the work program. So because of that, there's an automatically built-in amount of rigor.
For students, it can be a challenge, managing the balance between school, work, and life while keeping up with the pace of the country's biggest city.
My name is Carrie Ann Max Benitez, and I am a senior at Cristo Rey New York High School. I live in the Bronx. If you live in the Bronx like me, you have to wake up pretty early to take the train because delays happen. I'm in choir, chamber choir. I'm the stage manager of the dance team, and I'm in improv and drama.
There's no doubt that Carrie-Anne Max has a lot on her plate, but she's determined to make the most of her opportunity at Cristo Rey.
My parents were born in the Dominican Republic. Yeah, there is a lot of pressure because they didn't go to college, and because my parents want me and my sisters to like move up and have a better opportunity than they did.
On top of her course load, Carrie-Anne Max spends one day each week working for the law firm of Seward & Kissel in Manhattan.
I was really skeptical of working in a law firm because, you know, there's this stereotype that lawyers are scary or that working in a law firm is really intimidating.
And the unknowns can cut both ways. Professional offices are sometimes skeptical of bringing high school students into their corporate environments.
Hi, my name is Mary Walls. I'm the Director of Human Resources for the law firm of Seward & Kissel. Our student intern is Carrie-Anne Max Benitez. We lovingly call her Carrie. We were lucky to get her in my group. I believe I had lower expectations. Not sure of the level of skill that I would get from the intern or the student than really what came to pass the first day.
But any doubts were soon dispelled once Carrie-Anne Max settled into her new role.
She presents herself very professionally. She's dressed appropriately all the time. She never screams. She never yells. You know, it's not as if it was a typical student in high school during the day.
And once it became clear that Carrie-Anne Max was serious about the work-study program, she gradually took on more responsibilities.
And now as a senior, I get like really big projects. For example, right now, I'm scanning personnel files and putting them onto the law firm's database. And I do that for every person. And I have to make sure that everything is in order. So it's like a lot of work, but it's worth it because you get to see how everything builds up.
She actually communicates and interacts with a lot of the firm personnel now, including our executive director.
The firsthand experience is paying off. Carrie-Anne Max is earning money toward her education, building confidence, and fostering professional relationships that are sure to help down the road. Plus, the job is making this and other workplaces less intimidating.
Being there really changed my perspective on not only lawyers in a law firm, but workplaces in general. Like, they're very supportive of me. My coworkers, they're always asking me how I am. And now with the college process, they're very up to date with me and they're always asking me questions.
It's this type of growth that Cristo Rey knows will give its students a competitive edge, both when applying to colleges and then afterward when they look for jobs.
So my freshman year, I was at Merrill Lynch. It's really interesting because I'm one of the very few people that I know outside of Cristo Rey people who can say that they've had actual real internships as like a 14, 15, 16 year old.
That's a Cristo Rey New York alum. And his experience speaks to how this program often leads to opportunities after high school.
So my name is Ralph Washington. I was born and raised in Harlem, New York. I graduated from Cristo Rey in 2012. From Cristo Rey, I went to Amherst College, majored in economics. After graduating from Amherst, I started my career at Accenture as a management consultant.
The heavy course load and the work study proved crucial as Ralph navigated his next steps after graduation.
Cristo Rey is just like, it's an academically rigorous school, so it just helped me with like the core skills that I needed. I got that foundational knowledge from Cristo Rey, so I was able to actually hit the ground running at Amherst instead of playing catch-up.
For the past several decades, the surest way to land a steady, middle-class job was to go to college and get a degree. But the cost of tuition keeps going up, and the job market is changing. For students, it's a daunting reality. Again, here's teacher Ryan Sheb.
So 100% of our students graduate each year. That's a number that any high school in the city would dream of. And I think 98 to 99% go to four-year schools.
As for Carrie-Anne Max, while she doesn't see a future for herself in law, she's confident that her training at Cristo Rey will serve her going forward.
I want to go to college for musical theater, and I want to minor in education. After college, I'm hoping to find a teaching job also while trying to like pursue my dreams of being on Broadway and being a performer.
For The Takeaway, I'm Rob Gunther.
You can hear more from our series, America's New Credentials. It's on our website at thetakeaway.org/credentials. Let's go back more than 40 years now to June of 1976. Gerald Ford was still president, and over at the Social Security Administration, an aide named Alfred Skolnick wrote in the agency's monthly bulletin a cheery little message. He wrote, "During the past quarter century, private pension plans have enjoyed a healthy growth. The private pension movement is now a major contributor to the income maintenance needs of the American worker." Now, what Alfred Skolnick didn't know when he was writing that optimistic little missive was that corporate America would soon help engineer the beginning of the end of private pensions and the security they gave middle-class workers to retire at age 65. Guaranteed benefits started to go away. Capped contributions took their place. And by the late 80s, fewer American companies offered a guaranteed income after retirement. Instead, the accounts that so many of us have today, the 401k. Olivia Mitchell is executive director of the Pension Research Council at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And she says this move away from pensions is just one part of a drastically shifting future of retirement for American workers.
There are two kinds of retirement schemes we have in the U.S. for private sector workers. One is defined benefit pensions, and those are the traditional ones where they pay you an income for life once you retire. And then there's the defined contribution plans, which are the equivalent to the 401k plans, which are the new wave. So what's changed over the last 30, 40 years is that instead of most workers having defined benefit plans, today most workers with a plan have a 401k type plan.
How many older workers out there started their careers expecting a defined benefit pension for their retirement years who now at the end of their careers have found they just don't have it?
Well, the defined benefit plans during their heyday covered primarily highly paid unionized workers in autos, steel, railroads, heavy manufacturing. And so that's where the problem lies today. People who were covered for a big chunk of their lives are finding that their plans are not fully funded, and they may actually experience benefit cuts in retirement.
Now, is this because industries have failed or have waned, like the coal industry, the steel industry, or is it because the corporations have moved to shift their costs and define their costs and not have defined benefits anymore?
Well, there are many reasons that defined benefit plans have stumbled. And perhaps the biggest one is that the sectors in which these plans were concentrated have declined. In addition, the labor market has changed. Back in the good old days, people hoped to get a job at a big company, stay there for a lifetime, and then retire from the company with a pension benefit, which would pay them for their lifetimes. These days, things are different. Neither the companies nor the employees actually expect a full career at one company. So it's just a very different labor market we have today.
You know, Olivia, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg question here, it seems to me. Certainly, some of these industries have waned over the generations. Manufacturing jobs, many of them have left for overseas, where these pensions were a big part of the benefit package for years. At the same time, the unions that negotiated these benefits have also waned, have been debased by management, by government policies. I think only 11% of American workers now are in unions. Which of these forces came first, or are they co-occurring?
Well, the unions actually collectively acted with the government during World War II, because there was a period during which we had wage price controls to try to hold down inflation during the war. And the government and the unions together permitted some of the pressures on the labor market to be eased by offering workers some pensions. So it was really that period that gave rise in the U.S. to traditional defined benefit pensions. However, as I've said, they were not portable plans, so that if you left one employer and moved to another, you couldn't take your money with you. And unfortunately, they were not well funded even back then. So that gave rise to the bill called ERISA, Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. And the purpose of that law was to require companies to fully fund the benefits. Unfortunately, here we are in 2017, almost 2018, and plans are still not fully funded.
So, Olivia, let's talk about this in the context of the current economy. Wages are stagnant. We've seen report after report that American workers are taking home roughly the same amount of money that they did 20 years ago. Being asked to save in 401ks because pensions are no longer available. How does all of this combine to affect the retirement picture for a worker, let's say, who's 55 today?
Well, we have to remember that the U.S. retirement system is built on the notion of a three-legged stool. So one leg is Social Security, one leg is company pension, if you have it, and the third leg is individual private savings through your home, banking accounts, what have you. That metaphor for retirement security persists today. What I would say is that traditional defined benefit pensions are no longer going to be with us. Retirement accounts through 401ks are very much in the ascendance. I mean, they cover basically as much of the workforce now, there's pensions for as much of the workforce now as there was 40 years ago, but the mix has changed. The real concern I have, however, is that the defined contribution plans do not provide longevity protection. They do not make sure that you'll never run out of money as long as you live. And so I think that's one of the biggest policy needs, to ensure that we put back longevity protection into the retirement system.
Well, let's talk about one of the legs of that stool, that three-legged stool that you described before we go, Olivia. Social Security, the big tax bill, the tax cut is done in Congress. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, has a career-long dream of privatizing and cutting Medicare and Social Security. Now, to be clear, he hasn't said that he's going to try to do that in the new year, but he has talked about welfare reform. And a lot of people suspect that when Paul Ryan puts his head down at night, he's still dreaming of cutting Social Security. What would that mean for the state of retirement in America?
There's no question that the Social Security system is facing severe and huge shortfalls. The current system is $34 trillion underfunded, and the revenue coming in is going to be insufficient to meet benefit requirements for my grandma and your grandma and perhaps you and me very soon. So there's no question that we have to fix Social Security. And by the way, I think retirees will also feel some of the pain. I don't believe anyone is going to be held harmless in this problem. So what can we do? Well, I think the main thing that folks could do in their 50s and even in their 60s is think seriously about not retiring or retiring later if they possibly can. Not everybody will be able to, but those that can buy themselves a little bit of insurance by deferring retirement, claiming their benefits later, and potentially expecting less.
Well, as each of these three legs gets shorter, Olivia, the pensions, private savings because wages are stagnant, and now Social Security, how much longer should Americans expect to work if they're going to go past the traditional age of 65?
When Social Security was put into place back in the 30s, they picked age 65 as the normal retirement age because half of the people didn't live that long. That was the life expectancy back then. So if we were to emulate that philosophy, we would have the expected retirement age be maybe age 80.
Well, picture yourself at 80 years old, because Olivia Mitchell says you might not be on a lawn chair on a beach in Florida. You might be working in order to have enough money to survive retirement. Olivia Mitchell, Executive Director of the Pension Research Council at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Bryce. I'm calling from Salt Lake City, Utah. I started with a company 30 years ago that had a defined benefits pension plan, and within 7 years of me starting, they dissolved that pension plan and rolled everybody into a 401k. So today, I only have a 401k, and yes, I am absolutely relying on that to supplement any IRS benefits for my retirement.
Well, on tomorrow's show, we want to hear from you. Are you like Bryce? Were you working toward a pension for a private company that was significantly altered or taken away? 8778-MY-TAKE. We're going to continue this conversation on Friday. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.